welcome back to the Why Hockey Periodical podcast. We couldn't end the trade deadline discussion after 2 hours on Friday, which you listened to on Saturday, so we're adding more to it with a first-time Why Hockey guest. That's a new one. Haven't had one of those in a while. Travis Yost, TSN, my friend. How are you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing great. First time, long time. I get to say it now like I'm a caller into the show.
You listen to this show?
I have. I don't listen religiously, but I have heard your guys' podcast. And so, a little backstory for the people who do listen. When you had reached out, it was like, yeah, I've listened, and I'd love to jump on. We just couldn't make the timing pre-trade deadline work out well, but glad to be on the tail end of it.
I'm sure Tommy's going to be ecstatic that people listen to our long-winded discussions that go into random tangents. I have to start.
Well,
okay, go on.
I think the one thing that people can appreciate if they follow me on Twitter is they know I'm a total hockey degenerate watching Ducks games on Sunday nights and stuff. So, like, I'm always looking, especially for markets where the coverage isn't overly saturated, like Florida. You hunt for what the best locally is. So kudos to you guys. Nice job.
Very much appreciated. I want to bring up a story before we get into the meat of the thing here. I don't know if you remember this, but this is 9 years ago now. This was 2015. And I was doing a story when I was in college on hockey analytics, nascent hockey analytics, because this was 2015. And one of the people I had to reach out for this story was you. I don't know if you remember that.
I do not, and I'm telling you, that is so. One, that is an incredibly cool story. Now you're making me blush a tiny bit here. But two, holy crap, I am old. That is the other thing I'm realizing.
We're all old, man.
I just turned 35, man. We're getting up there.
I turned 30. We feel decrepit now. I'm about to go to the IHOP to get the senior discount. I have to say that was a long time ago, but it was a very fun story, and you were one of the rare people in media who has kept a job for 9 years in the same place. So congratulations, and I wish I was you. Anyway, I want to break up something also very briefly before we start, because it's been gnawing at the back of my brain since yesterday because of the Wild pulling their goalie in overtime, and it was John Hines doing it, which made no sense because he's not the cool coach. I would have thought Patrick Waugh would have done something like that. And the fact that everyone simultaneously learned a rule about hockey we didn't know about otherwise. It was like Donovan McNabb learning in real time that an NFL game could end in a tie. That if you pull your goalie in overtime, you get scored on an empty net, you lose the loser point. I legitimately didn't know that. I don't know how many hockey fans actually knew that.
I'll tell you right now, I did not. It wasn't, and if I knew, it was in my subconscious, right? I feel like it's one of those things that when, for all of us who were here at the onset of 3-on-3 being implemented in the NHL, it was probably something we read. We're like, yeah, that'll never happen. And then it gets deep six and you forget about it forever because it's never going to happen, except in these extraordinarily rare cases. I believe the only other example I found was early 2017. So it's comically rare. But the other thing, too, is it's almost, and this is saying something considering the NHL. It has to be the most arcane rule they've ever come up with. I mean, what's the point? I don't even understand it. So it added to the drama of the Wild game. It was super entertaining, but like, I don't even understand what the point of it was.
I actually kind of get it because when you think of it from their perspective, I mean, Mike Russo said it's when they put in the loser point in 99-2000. And I kind of get it because if you pull your goalie with no penalty in overtime, then it would just turn into who can get the puck and pull their goalie faster, and it would look like a power play. And that would be kind of boring. So especially in 3-on-3 where the goal is possession, if you got possession, you'd immediately pull your goalie. There's no penalty, and it's just a 4-on-3 power play for as long as you can maintain the puck. So I actually kind of understand it from that regard. But I love the note that the first team to ever lose a game via a goalie pull in overtime and lost the loser point was the Canucks. It could only have been Vancouver to lose that way the first time. Now, one other brief tangent here. You've definitely watched the John Boy's documentaries on the Vikings and the Falcons and the Mariners, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I'm a Bills fan.
Of course you are. So now I am going to continue my trumpeting of the idea that the next one of these has to be the Canucks. He just has to do the Canucks because you'd get 13 hours of stuff. And even in my brain and thinking about all the random Vancouver stuff that I've encountered and we've encountered in our years watching hockey, I didn't even know about this, and this is one of the craziest things that could ever happen in hockey. And of course, it was the Canucks that did it first. Please, John Boys, if you're somehow listening to this show, the Vancouver Canucks, goldmine of material. You'll have 15 hours of stuff, and you'll have to somehow cut half of it out.
Them, you could pair them, parlay them with a documentary over the 2010 to 2023 Ottawa Senators, and you would have enough hockey content off ice and ridiculous on ice stuff to last generations. So John Boys, take the advice of both of us here.
Yes. Okay, let's get to the actual hockey here, because while it is fun to think about random scenarios in hockey that will only happen twice, which is pulling your goalie in overtime and losing the loser point, the nexus for me reaching out to you was you wrote in January about the Panthers, and this was at the point where they were starting to rev it up. It was probably in the middle of the 9-game winning streak when they really turned a corner. And I think at the time people were starting to look at the Panthers and wonder, just how good are they? And I knew that they were good, but I didn't think they'd be this good. Certainly I didn't think they'd be leading the President's Trophy race at this point. And from your outside perspective, because we obviously were in the weeds. We watch all these games and we know the nitty-gritty details. But for you, what was the tell for you that the Panthers are not just, you know, this fluke that made the Stanley Cup final and got hot at the right time? There's something really, truly monstrous going on here. They're becoming a machine.
They checked a box which is extraordinarily difficult to check. Around that point in January when I wrote it, and you know, some of this is you're trying to build confidence. You don't want to react to one game. You don't want to wait for 80 games. Thank you to TSN for keeping me employed for 9 years. But I'm a man of very few skills, but one of the things I like to think I've done adequately is find that midpoint where it's not obvious to the average fan that something is happening behind the scenes, but maybe locally it's a little more obvious. And I think that's where the intersection between those two is. In January, what I saw from Florida, and keep in mind, right, it's a continuance of last year. What I see is one of the deadliest combinations you can be as an NHL team, which is a dominant puck possession team that has high-end shooting talent. We have seen any number of teams with high-end shooting talent. We've seen any number of teams with dominant puck possession. Some have been great. Some have been not so great. If you can combine those two, where you're persistently getting 55% of the shot share, and your top six is saturated with guys who are capable 35, 40 goal scorers, like is the case right now in Florida, you are just insanely difficult to beat, even with mediocre goaltending, right? And that's the other part of this story is, like, Florida's goaltending has started to rebound from where it was a couple years ago, and Bobrovsky's obviously been part of that in his kind of career renaissance, but there are just, if I asked you or I posed a question back in general terms of, can you name dominant puck possession teams with high-end shooting talent? There's probably only three or four that you're able to maintain, that you're able to rattle off. The most obvious comparable is actually in the West, and I'm going to get to the second box in a minute, but the Edmonton Oilers would be your sister team, right? But if I'm looking at Florida and I'm looking at a comparable, the Oilers would probably be the most likely. But I actually think a better comparable would have been the Avalanche of a couple years ago, where they play with so much tempo. They are constantly playing, they're constantly applying pressure, and they're playing ultra aggressive. And quite frankly, the only time you can really beat this team, especially over like a series, is if they are less aggressive than they normally are, or alternatively are making too many mistakes within that aggression. And we've seen pockets of that from the Avalanche, who I think were, you know, definitely a quality comparable for the Panthers. That's the one piece, which to me is major recognition of the Panthers. The other piece is I don't want to say it's just as important, but it's pretty damn close. The Eastern Conference ain't that great. Like I really emphasize this. Like, there are a lot of capable teams, maybe even a half dozen good teams. But like, if I look around the Eastern Conference and I'm trying to figure out a team post the Bergeron era in Boston that I would be like, yeah, I think they're very game in a 7-game series against Florida, the way they're playing right now. Honestly, the only two teams that come to mind, one are the New York Rangers, because they have enough talent and you can get goalied in a series against them because they have that component. The other team that I just persistently have immense respect for, and they've had any number of, you know, especially when they were occupying the same division and fighting with each other year after year, the Carolina Hurricanes are always going to be a very difficult matchup. And those two teams, all right, the reality is with the play the playoff format set up, you may only play one of those teams, if even one of them. So I also think some of this is Florida's path has also really eased, right? Like it's you're not the Tampa Bay step backwards, Boston step backwards, Toronto really hasn't taken any step, and I would argue if anything they've taken a step backwards. Carolina, who I still think of as a great team, I don't think is the best version of Carolina that we've seen. Juxtapose that against what I think in the Western Conference is rare, really the top end talent is between Colorado, Dallas, Winnipeg, Edmonton. If you're a believer in Vancouver, you have to include them. And then what the Golden Knights did once again at the trade deadline. I mean, to me, that's six teams. Maybe take out Winnipeg, maybe take out Vancouver. And the most generous math possible, there are at least four really tough matchups for Florida that are in the Western Conference. And I think the combination of I'm very bullish on the Panthers and the depth and the breadth of how talented and skilled they are throughout the lineup, combined with an easier path out of the East, I got to be honest, I think they're my favorite out of the East, and I think they've been my favorite since about December or so.
What's fascinating about the Panthers is when you made your comparables to Edmonton and to Colorado, they play differently. The Panthers are, in a way, they play much more similar to the 21-22 Avs than they do to this year's Oilers, who they beat twice. Yep. But I think the difference is that the Panthers completely changed their identity in 2 years. And last year, I was very skeptical that they could do that. And then in the playoffs, as my co-host said, to the spirit of the system they played, and that was what got them through, and then they got hot. But this year's team, they're playing what they're being asked to do in a really dominant way, and that's a credit to Paul Maurice, who everyone laughed at for the Winnipeg stuff for years, but now I think people have to come around to realizing he's actually a really good coach, and he got exactly what he wanted out of this group in a way that I certainly didn't see coming. And I think that's the other part of it. It's not, we see all these teams that got really good on the rush, they get into the playoffs and they find that it's so much harder to keep doing this. You know, the Devils were, for instance, the Panthers in 21-22 were exactly like this. But this team's not like that, and that's why they could be really successful, is because they generate so much, so many different ways. And one of our pet peeves all year was that you were talking about shooting talent, and I agree, they've got a lot of it, but they were still, if you look at every one of those numbers on Money Puck or wherever, they're shooting under expected too. Like, they leave offense on the table in some ways because of the way they play. And the style is sustainable, and that's the thing that makes it even more interesting to me. Because,
yeah,
like,
that's exactly why I think the Colorado team from a few years ago is the best comparable, because it's not like, Florida's a fast team, but they're not like blazing up and down the ice. What I think they do, especially in the offensive third, they apply relentless pressure. I think they're second in the league in multi-shot shifts. If I looked at my data, I don't have it in front of me, of course. I think they're second in the league in multi-shot shifts. The other piece is their ability to collect loose pucks and win pucks and force turnovers in the offensive zone and still play within those five-man units and maintain pressure. You get these crazy long shifts for opposition blue lines that the Panthers feast on. And yes, it may be a shade of this, a shade of a similar color, but not exact to how the Avalanche did it a few years ago, but it's just constant pressure. You constantly feel like you're under siege when you got the Barkov line out there. And that, like, it in many ways, maybe it's, you could even go back further to what, I don't think they had the shooting talent, but it's almost like a midpoint between the Avalanche team of a couple years ago and what we remembered from like the Kopitar Kings when they were in their prime, where it was like, you physically can't get the puck from these lines on some of these shifts. Like it's truly impossible. And they've taken like the very good of LA of 10 years ago, the very good of Colorado. And like I say, like, it's not like this team is flawless. Like, I still think they're leaving a little bit to be desired on the blue line, but like, you look at their top nine as a forward group, and if you're bullish on Bobrovsky being a capable goalie with Stolarz backing him up, like, you have the ingredients to beat just about every team in the league. You certainly are going to be a favorite in most of the series, if not all of them in the East. And quite frankly, the teams that maybe have a 40, 45, 48% chance of beating you, there's probably only three of them, right? So you may only draw one or two. And I'm not trying to get Panthers fans like comically excited. I think the Panthers have done a good enough job of doing that myself. But like it is a game of relativity too, and you're only as good or as bad as your competition is. And right now, you know, right now Florida has a little bit of a more favorable road than they probably would have if this same team existed 3 years ago. I think that road is more challenging. Right? You got to get through Tampa, you got to get through Boston, you got to get through Toronto. All three of those teams were better 3 years ago. So I think timing is also.
Well, you got to get lucky too, obviously, and they did run into two of those Tampa teams and lost to them and learned a lot from them. I think a lot of the criticism that you see about. Certainly, Toronto fans got mad about this. I don't know what it is, playing dirty, but playing up to the line and then pushing the other team over the line is very Tampa-esque. That they learned from the Lightning, who were the kings of it. And it cost them in two series. I go back to the Sam Bennett suspension in 21, being the Panthers not knowing what that was like, and then learning from that and internalizing it. It's why I think the Panthers and Lightning have the best rivalry in hockey, even though I don't think enough people admit it. And the NHL does not want to do an outdoor game between the teams because whatever. But the one thing about Bobrovsky, I think that people should think about a little bit more. And if you're a dedicated listener to Y Hockey, you've heard me mention this, and I know you are, and it's fantastic to hear that. Sergei Bobrovsky's best years were under a torch system where the shots, where they were coming from, how they were coming was really predictable because it's a torch system. Defensively aggressive, we know all of that. And then he comes to Florida, and they're playing this open run-and-gun Quenneville Brunette style, and it didn't mesh with him. He would always go out and make some crazy saves, and then a couple plays later, because he's tired and he's got to get back to the position, he'd give up one where you'd go, he really needs to save that. Last year was kind of the same. He was getting a grasp of the system, and eventually he kind of found that groove in the playoffs. This year, the team in front of him, they're giving away nothing. And in October, I looked at MoneyPuck, and I was looking at their expected goals, and their expected goals were high once again. But it wasn't because of what they were generating. It was because of the fact that they were giving up nothing. And I was going in going, okay, this is different. This is not the same Panthers team that I've seen, where they'd still be middle of the pack in what they'd give up, but they'd be so dominant offensively that it didn't matter. This year's team, well, they're still generating a ton offensively. What they give up defensively, they give up nothing. And the system they play, the way they tailor it to the defensemen that they have, and the skill sets that they have, that's why I never understood the Hanifin rumors, because the Panthers' defense, even with Ekman, Larson, and Kulikov and Mikula, they've just made them work in how they play. And very good teams figure out how to take, now I don't want to say spare parts, because that's not being kind to them, and fits them into a system that works, and they're getting the most out of all of those guys. And that, to me, is the other part that is hugely impressive. And why, even without Ekblad again, I don't worry about them even going into difficult games. Because, like, the system gives them the license to do the simple things they have to do to let everyone else go forward. And part of that is because, and I'll leave it here because I want to talk about other teams. But I know you've heard all the time about, you know, positionless hockey. How do we get, essentially, defensemen to play like forwards? The Panthers' secret sauce is, how do you get your center to play like a defenseman? And that's why their defensive numbers are so great, because you have Barkov, who is the best defensive center in the game, and then you have the other centers following suit. Bennett's playing that way, Lundell's playing that way, and there aren't teams in the league that can do that. Like, the Oilers can't do that. The Avalanche, for as good as they are, really can't do that. And that might be the difference when they get to the playoffs, is they can play a total team defensive game led by their center in a way that even the elite teams of the West can't do.
I agree, with one exception. The team that can do it, they haven't shown it recently, but I'm pretty sure they can, is the team that beat them in the Stanley Cup last year.
Yes.
And I think that's a real, and by the way, it goes to, so 2 points, and I'll close real quick. On the Hanifin point, I completely agree. It didn't make a ton of sense for the immediacy of this year. But I do think if you look at Florida's blue line, you know that's a position they're going to have to invest in over the next few years. And the longevity potential with Hanifin and his contract was alluring, because I believe half or more than half of Florida's active blue line expires. And I believe most of them are UFAs. And full credit to them, right? They've kind of done this like ragtag group They've got a handful of guys they've gotten through waivers playing regular minutes. Like, to me, that's a comp. It's a testament to what the Florida Panthers have been able to do. And it's underpinned how much they can invest at the forward position. I do think that train's going to come back to the station, though, at some point. It sounds like it more so this summer and onwards than anything. The other piece on the goaltending, real quick, you laid it out beautifully. This is the way I think about it. Save percentage is a predominantly, team measurement. It is not an individual goaltender statistic. To me, that is a canard. It's a long-established canard. And when you saw the decay in the Florida Panthers save percentage, a lot of that was that up-tempo, brunette style, we're going to trade chances left and right. How you knew it was problematic for Bobrovsky was his goals versus expected, which to me is much more meaningful in terms of how a goaltender is erasing or adding to the goals against total. And in Bobrovsky's case, you marry up that data with watching him on video. It was just very clear he wasn't very comfortable in that role and increasingly was giving up bad goals against in a way that we really hadn't seen either previously in Florida or previously in Columbus. So that's the way I think about the goaltending position. It's always a bit of a riddle, but like you said, I think they are well-equipped. I think they're as equipped as anyone in the East. And quite frankly, to your point, like, there aren't that many teams in the West that they can't beat in a series. I do think Vegas will be a problem. I do think Edmonton would be a problem. I do think Dallas would be a problem. But again, you're only going to play one of them if you make it there. So good opportunity here for the Panthers.
It's going to be a nerve-wracking postseason because the last couple were kind of found money. You know, 2022 was, they won a series, thank God, even though they embarrassed themselves against the Lightning. And last year, thank God they got in. And then it doesn't occur to you until later that, oh my God, they're doing this and this run is pretty crazy. The Rangers were always a matchup, kind of troubling for the Panthers. They had not played well against them. They've beaten them two times this year. And Carolina was always a matchup problem for them. And last year, they won because they had Matthew Tkachuk and Sam Reinhart, and the Hurricanes didn't. It was moments. And the Hurricanes have a few more moments players now with Gensel and Svechnikov back. So I think they are going to be a threat because they play very similarly, and there's going to be nothing going on when those two, the margins are so tight, and they just, and the moments players are, is the, that was the difference last year in the series. And I understood what Rod Brindamore's point was. Anyway,
if you ask me to stack the best two East Conference teams right now, it's Florida 1, Carolina 2. And I'd have to think hard about 3 because I think it's debatable. But I think those are your top two right now.
I think it would be the Rangers because they've got the goalie and they have moments players and centers, which the Bruins don't. And I would put Boston 4. But for another time, trade deadline things that we saw that you liked. I you could go on about Vegas. We'd talk about Thomas Hertl because I find that trade, because it's Vegas, I find it fascinating. Not just because we've kind of lost track of Thomas Hertl and, you know, retiring a goalie when he came into the league with the crazy stuff he was doing. It's not that same player, but, like, it's just what they do, and they find the way to get even deeper. And, I mean, you don't want Mark Stone having a ruptured spleen. That's awful. But they were willing to take advantage. And, like, when you put everything, I don't know if they're going to even be able to put everything together, but, like, they're the second wildcard team right now. Like, congrats if they end up being the first wildcard team and you play the Central winner. That's terrifying. That's a great reward for winning your division. But, like, is because they are the defending champs and they probably will figure it out at some point, although they haven't been lately. Like, what is it that stands out about this Vegas team? Because they had that red-hot start and they've been bad recently, but they're still Vegas, you know, stack up to the rest of the West because it's the move that drew the most headlines and obviously the most shock of all the deadline moves.
Yeah, so on the Vegas Golden Knights, I find them fascinating because I do think they are the best run franchise in the NHL right now. And a lot of it goes to what I see as a cohesive strategy from that brain trust. Now, keep in mind, some of that is fortune. Some of that is misfortune, but they've taken their landscape. They've taken their environment and have figured out a way to manipulate like 2/3 of the rest of the league. And what I mean by that, and I really do encourage people who are listening to this, go to tsn.ca, read the article I posted today, because I think the math is incredible to read. Long story short, right? Like, so Vegas has played terribly for a couple months. They're in the second wild card position. They're very likely to make the playoffs, but you don't want to go in as a second wild card team. But what do the Golden Knights do? Once again, they add meaningfully at the trade deadline, right? It wasn't just Anthony Mantha, who was hey, that's a great rental for a cheap price, right? They go and add Thomas Hurdle from San Jose, who's got this long-term deal, very similar to Mark Stone, very similar to Jack Eichel. The Golden Knights have taken roster building as we know it and have done a complete 180. They build their roster, at least the core components of their roster, over the course of the regular season, frequently at the trade deadline. Where they clean up their roster is in the offseason. That's when they are sellers. And I think a lot of people, what people have missed with the Golden Knights, the constant fixation over them gaming and injuries to circumvent the cap. First off, it's ridiculous. Like, they're a terrible team without Mark Stone and Jack Eichel on the ice. They're not benefiting from this in any way. That's number one. But number two, people fixate on, oh, yep, they're going into the playoffs with a $95 million cap. Once again, yes, they are absolutely leveraging long-term injured reserve, which, by the way, almost every single team in the league currently is, including the Coyotes, who use it to get out of having any semblance of a roster whatsoever, right? So to the extent this is an issue, this is a league-wide issue, number one. Number two, when people fixate on why do teams keep giving their talent to Vegas in the summer or at the trade deadline, it's because teams are constantly trying to shed salary in this slower cap growth era. And at the trade deadline, the prevailing theory historically was, well, you get maximum return on your assets. Not so much anymore. And Vegas continues to show that they're buying quality players at a fraction of the cost because they force the other team to retain salary, just like they did with San Jose. And the other piece, and what gets lost in all of this, I went back and looked since the Mark Stone addition. The Knights have added almost like something like 25 net $25 million in single season cap hits around the trade deadlines over the last 4 or 5 years, which is a pretty big number. What people miss is they have shed $45 million of net cap in the subsequent off seasons. So not only are teams lining up to continue to accommodate Vegas at the trade deadline, who remain contenders, who remain buyers, and who will deploy capital to build their roster, they then accommodate them 3 months later and take their crappy contracts, because guess what teams have in the off season that they don't right now? They'll have some cap space. And you know what? Yeah, you know what? If you send us a third round pick, we'll take on that dead contract. And the Golden Knights are more than happy to do so. So they leverage their trade partners and get them to retain salary for meaningful players every trade deadline. Then they turn around in the subsequent summer and clean up their balance sheet and send whatever crap they want to get rid of around the league. The key thing when you read this article, and I promise you, it's going to be worth your time. Look at the trades they have made in the off seasons. There isn't a single trade of consequence made, yet they shed $45 million in cap. That is how the Golden Knights continue to build their roster. And until teams catch on, or until you start seeing big growth return to the NHL, that arithmetic's not going to change. And it's why the Golden Knights, in my opinion, are the class of the NHL right now.
You find it amusing because the first trade that popped into my head was trading Max Pacioretty to the Hurricanes for nothing. Now, it didn't work out for Carolina, nothing. But we were all laughing at that trade because it's like, what are you doing, Vegas? And they don't get burned by it because, of course, they don't. But it is really interesting because when you put it that way, it's like they do their big business at the trade deadline and then they dump everything in the summer for bargain bin prices and they don't really care. Because remember, they had the Shea Weber LTI contract for a few years, which I remember somehow. It's such a good
they
one.
They also had Clarkson. They did the same thing with David Clarkson. That's right. Why I'm saying, like, this table, it is ripe of the Webbers and the Clarksons on that side of the house. It's ripe with the Pacioretty-type deals, Paul Stastny, Riley Smith. I mean, Riley Smith was a good player when they traded him. He goes to Pittsburgh, doesn't work out. They have not been burned one time yet as a seller in the summer. Now, a couple trades they have made have not worked. It's not like they're flawless, right? The Thomas Tatar trade kind of not famously blew up. It didn't work out. And at some point, these older players with big contracts are going to force them into the typical rebuild cycle that every team is not unique. Vegas is not immune to it. It will come. But the reason why they have remained so competitive is they have taken advantage of most of the other teams around the league who remain willing to accommodate them. And it is not about sending them talent at the trade deadline. It's more so about taking whatever they want to do in the summer. And I bring up this last point, and I wish I included it in the article, but I did make the point on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it.
Twitter.
You know, Twitter. Let's go with Twitter. When is the last time we've talked about Marc-Andre Fleury, Vegas Golden Knights?
Again, I hadn't thought of it that way because we haven't. We haven't. It's not crazy. I mean, last year they won with 70 goaltenders. I mean,
it's unbelievable. Again, like, get it right. Like, some of it is fortune, right? And right now the odds have been with Vegas, and we've seen team like, to be good, you have to be ran well. You have to have a smart front office, a quality coaching staff, depth in your lineup. But some of it is random chance, right? Some of it is like, you need fortune. And like, Vegas has had a tremendous amount of luck when it comes to roster building in the trade front. And quite frankly, they've had a lot of luck across the board. I would argue, though, they have been unlucky with injuries. The difference is they have taken that misfortune with injuries and have turned it into a positive, where other teams just sit there and say, well, we're screwed. Off to next year. That's not going to be the case for the Golden Knights, and it doesn't seem like it ever will be with Bill Foley and McCrimmon running the show there.
Can I make one point? I don't want to hold you forever. I wish I could.
No.
But one point I wanted to make is, because this debate is happening again, and I talked about this on the Saturday show, how much I hate this, which is the idea of the cap is exploding, the no-tax states are going to have advantages. And to me, this isn't about the no-tax state having advantages for players. It's that teams that happen to be in low or no-tax states are the best-run teams in the league. Vegas, Florida, Tampa, Dallas, Nashville's pretty decent, Carolina, what have you, right? And now the higher-tax U.S. teams are going, well, wait, this could affect us because the cap's going to go up. And I said on the Saturday show, and I'll say it here, it's a shame that you're just not as well-run as those teams are. You're not doing what Vegas is doing. You're not putting in the effort that the Panthers are to become Tampa East, essentially. Or you're not doing what Dallas is doing. For 15 years ago, there were maybe one good team in the Sun Belt run properly. The rest of them were dregs. The Panthers were the worst-run franchise in post-sports in North America for two decades. You know, and the better-run teams were up north. And now, the better-run teams are in the Sun Belt. It's cyclical. But when you hear the complaints about it from the Canadian teams or the Buffaloes of the world, you just need to be run better. Congrats that Kelly McCrimmon have...
Could not agree more. Could not agree more. And this is what I would say. Is it an advantage to be in Nevada or Florida? Yes, but it is a marginal one at best. It is not the reason. It's not even a tertiary reason. These organizations are so well run, and you see it on the small contracts, right? People affix to Matthew Tkachuk and Mark Stone and say, well, they got the bag. Of course they're going there. They don't want to get hit by the income tax. Fine and well, right? Like, to the extent that that's a variable, I concede that. The key thing, though, is look what Florida and Vegas and these other teams do. Dallas is another example. What do they do to build out the rest of the roster where state income tax is probably not going to factor and no one's ever even raised it as an argument, right? Like, that is where that argument kind of falls apart. And honestly, I've more considered it as a way for Canadian markets and Canadian fan bases to grieve the economic differences between Canada and the United States, which I actually may have a little more meat on that bone. But this takes us both into a discussion. I could spend 8 hours. I hate the NHL's hard cap. I think it's terrible. They should go to a soft cap system. This is yet another area where you would see benefits for the league economically, for the franchises that drive the league's economics. It would also be helpful for revenue sharing and the Ponzi scheme going on in Phoenix. Like, it just checks so many other boxes. But that's, again, that's a discussion for another day. But I could not agree more with that point. It is a very small sliver in terms of the overall arithmetic for decisions made or not made.
Well, I have my disagreements with you on the cap, but we'll have to have you back on for that for another discussion. My point about these athletes is they can all register in the Cayman Islands anyway. You're a wealthy athlete. You're a wealthy human being. Do what every other wealthy person does and hide your taxes. But the second thing about it is I always thought of it as a proxy that our teams aren't as well run as these other ones. And in Canada, that is like readily apparent that a lot of these teams are not as well run as they should be. And that's the team's fault. You need to be better run. You can market the advantages of living in Ontario or living in Manitoba because there are advantages. Firstly, you're going to be able to insure your house because the insurance companies aren't worried a hurricane's going to blow it away. Or in the case of Vegas, that your roof is going to melt because it's 130, for instance. But anyway, we could go down that rabbit hole forever. We could also have you on forever, but you got to run. So I'll give you one more question. Is trade deadline move that you like, team that you like, that did moves that were Vegas level, but that you really liked and that you think is going to set them up well down the stretch and into the playoffs?
Oh boy. All right, I'm going to answer this. I'm going to be on the fence for this one, which is a weak answer, but I actually really like the addition of Adam Henrique in Edmonton. I know Oilers fans, I think Oilers fans were critical and maybe somewhat fairly of what the front office did not do because the Western Conference was adding like crazy, including the Pacific Division. However, to the extent that Edmonton did add, I think Adam Henrique fits in that lineup almost perfectly. I had written a few weeks ago that he was like, if I were searching for a singular player to add to the Oilers lineup, it would be Adam Henrique, for a number of reasons. He's so capable, two-way. He adds to the depth. That's the one area of pocket of weakness in the Oilers that we've seen over the years. Similarly, you can raise an argument that the Oilers should have done more on the blue line. No upgrade over Nurse, no upgrade over CeCe. But specific to a trade, I think Adam Henrique was a fantastic add. And honestly, I'll bring this full circle. What Florida did to Ottawa, talk about one organization well run, one organization not well run. On full display with the Vladimir Tarasenko trade, right? The Panthers got another player for 80 cents on the dollar who goes right into their top six. A very talented player. And by the way, go back 9 months. What was Ottawa's investment thesis on Tarasenko? I have utterly no idea and probably will never know. But I did love that trade for the Panthers as well.
I also want to focus, we talked about it on the Friday to Saturday show. I don't even, released it Saturday, recorded it Friday, whatever. So interested in the Avs and Mittelstadt. Like, the Stanley Cup could be determined on whether the Avs are right about him. I legitimately think if they have a 2C that they might be the best team in the West, but it's such an open question whether they do or not. Because last year, the MacKinnon line killed everybody, was utterly dominant, and then anybody else was on the ice in Seattle was better. And it reminded me of a better version of the Panthers' late talent era, where Barkov's line would go on the ice, destroy everybody, incredible dominance, and then the rest of the team was a black hole, and that was the Avs last year. So if Mittelstadt's good and is what they think he could be in Colorado, then I think that changes the dynamic of the West completely. Because if not, then I think Colorado could easily go out in the first round again.
They had to add someone. I'm still skeptical. However, I have to concede Mittelstadt has been great for the first half of this season with Buffalo. So I think they saw just enough from that to say, yeah, we think that there's more to tap into. To your point, not only did Seattle do that to him, I believe Vegas did it to him the year prior, right? Didn't they blow the Knights off the ice like 6-1 in game one? And then
yeah, it was 21. They crushed him in the two games in Denver, and then the whole thing flipped.
Same issue. And by the way, it came right back to what is the depth or lack thereof look like across this team. It seemed a certainty they were going to add at the forward position for that reason, and that's what they did. Interesting to see how Byram shakes out in Buffalo, because I still think that's a work in progress. That's still TBD. If he pans out, boy, the Sabres got one hell of a blue line up there in Buffalo. So I think in terms of most fascinating trade, that one-for-one deal would be the top of the list.
My one concern about the Sabres, and I'll end it here, is that I worry that blue line is too samey. There's a lot of sameness in the guys they have. They're all really good. They're all incredibly fun, but they all kind of profile the same. And what worries me is when you're trying to do the work you need to do, you know, if you have the similar kind of profile, the matchups become a problem. And as you get later into your evolution as a team, if you match up the same against your lines or pairings, anyway, you have to go back to work and look at Bill's free agent news, and I have to go see if the Jaguars screwed up by letting Calvin Ridley walk, because speaking of terrible teams, well, nobody seems to think about going to play for the Jaguars because you get lower taxes, for instance. Anyway, Travis, where can people find you if they don't already?
You can find me at TSN.ca, and you enjoy Gabe Davis and his 70,000 drops this season. I'm still bitter about him, but that guy was a all-time love-him-hate-him player in Buffalo. I wish him the best of luck in Jacksonville, but he was maddening. So good luck with that.
If he can block on the few running plays for the Jaguars that could be successful and give up some space for Christian Kirk and Evan Engram, I'll be fine. They have bigger problems. Thank you, Travis. It's been a pleasure.
Take care, man.